All right. Well, thanks. Sorry for the delay. It's great to be back here. I'll tell you some work from half my lab does olfaction, half does hippocampal circuitry. And I was here last time we did this 3 or 4 years ago. And I'll tell you a couple of aspects of the hippocampal story. And some of that second story was work that was inspired by the conversations we had here. So it really seems nice to come back and tell you about it. I am just coming from 4 days camping in the Sespe, so hopefully the coffee will make me go through this without passing out here. All right, so I want to just begin, because I know, I guess this week you've been talking about hippocampus in terms of place cells and navigation. And I wanted to begin by sort of talking about how we're coming at the hippocampus, which is more in terms of how short-term memories might function, which is typically associated with neocortical regions and prefrontal cortex. But I want to make a connection to what we're seeing in the hippocampus by setting up sort of the classic work on delayed response tasks, which is really as simple as just having two cups and a ball is under one of the two cups. And if you ask a child to do this, they can do this from a very early age. As long as they can attend to that, they can tell you which cup the ball is under. But if you distract the child, then they can't do this task until about age 2, which corresponds to the time that the reciprocal connections between prefrontal cortex and medial dorsal thalamus develop. So that was part of the argument that this storing the information about which cup the ball is under involves this cortical circuit. And doing this in a monkey was done several times in several different places to establish this kind of delayed response task. I'll show you a little bit of data from Pat Goldman and Rakesh, where instead of having a cup, they had a monkey that was trained to fixate on a video screen, and there was a fixation point. And then briefly, one of these lights went on in the periphery. That light went off. And then when the fixation point went off, the monkey was trained to make a saccade in the direction of the light that was on. And that's the equivalent idea of a delayed response task to look at working memory. And what they found, Pat Goldman and Rakesh's lab, was when they did extracellular recordings in prefrontal cortex, they found three classes of cells, and two of which were trivial. Right? So there were cells that were in prefrontal cortex, but they responded directly to the light, which one of these lights went on. And these were Q period, but they were living in prefrontal cortex, but essentially behaving like visual cells. And the other trivial class of cells were cells whose spiking increased during the saccade. So these were also prefrontal cells, but they were behaving like premotor cells. And these are our raster peristimulus time histogram rasters, so they're showing the average activity over multiple trials. The interesting part, the reason this work is in textbooks, is there is a class of cells in prefrontal cortex in the monkey that have spiking activity during this period where the monkey has to remember which light was on and then show you that it remembered that. And this delay period activity was the key to this, because if they looked at trials where the monkey made a mistake, this activity wasn't there. And this activity was also tuned. So this is an example of a kind of persistent firing mode. So this is an extracellular recording in a monkey that's behaving in this task to show you it's got a short-term memory. We can directly associate this firing with the memory because of the error trials. And so the fundamental question that remains from this work that's now several decades old is, how do you get this persistent firing? Right? And we're interested in that question, which is still an open question. And we're coming at it from sort of our view of the cortex and of the hippocampus. And this is an image from Santagati showing all the beautiful cells, inner neurons and pyramidal cells, and their synaptic connections in the neocortex. We'd like to understand at this level how this sort of persistent firing mode occurs. And what we've focused on is not in neocortex, although we're starting to work on neocortex as an extension of this work, but in a simpler brain region within the hippocampus an even simpler version within what's called the dentate gyrus, and I'll be mostly showing you recordings from dentate hilar cells. These are cells that receive input diasynaptically from and around a cortex. The perforant path comes in, landing on the dendrites of these granule cells. The granule cells send information along the trisynaptic pathway to CA3, but along the way, they form collaterals in the hilus. And I'll show you more about that. So I'm going to show you a couple of different stages of the work. I'm going to demonstrate in a slice that we can get a persistent activity. We can show you a little bit about the mechanism of that and how this actually can encode information in a slice. So this is from Cajal. This is, the organization, the perforant path coming in. This is the granule cell layer. So this is the dentate gyrus. He doesn't have any cells in the hilus, but he certainly knew about these cells, so he just simplified the diagram. And he put on these handy arrows to demonstrate the direction of information flow from dentate granule cells to CA3 to CA1. So we're going to be in here, in the rat, in a brain slice, without any tricks, without any pharmacology. So what we see are these, this is a Nissl stain, this is the dentate granule cells, the hilus, CA3. So what we found to start off this project was simply activating the perforant path. So we're stimulating the perforant path and recording in the hilus. So we're two synapses away. And the first thing we found was trivial, that if you stimulate here hard enough, you can activate a disynaptic EPSP. And this is a unitary EPSP because we see failures and successes, and it's entirely blocked by the AMPA receptor antagonist NBQX. Right? So it's a disynaptic activation. We're not seeing the granule cells here, but some of them are activated to give you this EPSP. The funny thing about the hilus, which is unique in the brain slice world for the hippocampus, is that the hilar cells that live here have a spontaneous synaptic tone. And that's what makes this whole work on trying to see cell assemblies possible in a brain slice. So these cells, for some unknown reason, have, just in a normal slice, lots and lots of synaptic potentials kicking away, producing EPSPs. We're holding at a potential to close to null the IPSPs, but there are spontaneous IPSPs too. And so they're EPSPs, and when we stimulate here weakly to generate these disynaptic EPSPs, we don't change the spontaneous tone. Right? So nothing's different. But if we do this a little bit stronger, so instead of minimal, we go to super minimal, we still see this evoked response right at the stimulus, where we dramatically change the synaptic tone. Right? So we go from this amount of spontaneous EPSPs to this amount, and it stays this way for seconds in a conventional rat hippocampal slice.
Ben? Yep. Probably getting ahead of your story, but you're going to tell us something must be spiking, right?
Yes.
The hilar cells?
No, the origin of this comes from a weird cell type that I'll get to in a minute. It's not the granule cells. But yes, something is spiking between the stimulus, the pathway we're activating, and the cells we're recording from.
So it's, it's kind of dangerous to draw inferences because once you put something in a slice, you change all sorts of stuff. So you can go from spontaneous active to not spontaneous active. And you, of course, you know what you're doing, right?
So we also can do this in vivo. Okay. So we can record these hilar cells in rat, in a mouse in vivo. We can also do this in a mouse slice.
So just to be clear, is it slightly stronger stimulation?
Yeah, I'll show you this in a second. Right now I'm just saying this is minimal, defined in the case where we have failures and successes for the disynaptic. This will work at about 2 or 3 times minimal. I'll show you this quantitatively in a minute. All right. So this is that figure here. This is just simply quantifying this by looking at the frequency of spontaneous EPSPs to begin with, and just in a 4-second window after this stimulus, the second stimulus, frequency goes up over a bunch of experiments, whereas before there's, with a low intensity where we had failures and successes, there's no change. We can look at this increase here, and we don't see this at minimal, we don't see it at twice minimal, by 3 times minimal we see it 70% of the time, and 10 times minimal we see it 100% of the time in a conventional slice without any drug treatment. This is unusual, so in most brain areas, in vivo or in vitro, if you turn up the intensity, you have a balance between inhibition and excitation. And in almost every brain area, the inhibition wins. Right? So you see the largest temporal domain of excitation, in this example from neocortex, at relatively weak stimuli. So this is an EPSP and an IPSP. As you turn up the intensity, the EPSP just gets sculpted into this tiny little part here, and the rest is IPSP. Right? And so there's this window where you can see a long duration EPSP, but then as you turn up the intensity, inhibition overwhelms everything. This is a slice, neocortical slice. Right? Whereas in the dentate hyalus, for some unusual reason, as you turn up the intensity, you go from sort of no long-lasting response to a excitatory long-lasting response. So it's a different circuit, and it's it breaks the rule of having increasing intensity recruit more and more inhibition and have a smaller and smaller domain of excitation. So this activity we can see not only as EPSPs, we can see this as spiking. This is a multi-unit recording in the hyalus. This is cell attached. Both of them show persistent spiking. The time course is in the range of 6 or 7 seconds on average for this to decay. And the origin of this then was the big question. So what we have is, I set this up by talking about Pachelbel and Rakish and working memory, and there you have neocortex in vivo in a behaving animal showing these delayed cell responses that go on for seconds that can encode information. Here, at least in a slice, what we can do is mimic that persistent activity. Right? And this, there are lots of potential explanations for this, how this can get there, and we'll get there in a minute. The most obvious explanation is the granule cells, which are the main input to these Hyler cells in CA3. Maybe those are spiking during this period when we're seeing the synaptic input. And that turns out to be not true. If we record granule cells, this is one visualized after filling it with Alexa, we see just IPSPs. And we've done this many, many times, and the granule cells don't respond in any sort of persistent way. In fact, they're inhibited during this response. So,
Ben, do you have the endorhinal cortex cut off on your slices?
Not in this example, but we did that as a control. So we can cut off CA3, we can cut off endorhinal, we still see this phenomenon. And so there are a couple of different explanations for this. So there is a class of cells that have intrinsic persistent activity. Right? And so Michael's worked on this and in endorhinal cortex. And in some of these areas, this happens with some modulation. So if you activate muscarinic receptors, you can see this long-lasting after discharge in endorhinal cortex. Unusual interneuron we found in the olfactory bulb, Lanus cells, has this sort of behavior without any sort of modification of the pharmacology. But when we look in the Hyler cells, we don't see this. We don't see any sort of persistent intrinsic activity. And so the graduate student who was working on this said, well, this is going to be great. Because if it's not intrinsic to the Hyler cells, the classic view from the textbook is you get persistent activity through reverberation. Right? So the classic view of how you would get a working memory-like persistent firing mode is having a bunch of excitatory cells that are interconnected. Right? And if you have those interconnection circuits strong enough and dense enough, then you can get a transient input that can trigger this persistent firing mode. And this has not been shown in a slice, and we thought this is the first time we could actually see this reverberation. Since it's a slice, the circuitry is contained, we can actually show the mechanism. So 500 some odd paired recordings later, the graduate student was rather depressed because we had done the connectivity in the hyalus in the slice, and the frequency of excitatory cells talking to excitatory cells was tiny, 0.5%. Right. The excitatory cells primarily talk to the interneurons in the hyalus, that's about 6%. The most frequent synaptic connection is from an interneuron onto the excitatory cell, and that's 15%. So we don't see the synaptic circuit that's necessary for reverberation, you know, at this tiny connection probability in a slice. This is certainly an underestimate of what the connections are in vivo, but the phenomenon works in the slice, and so we'd like to assume that the circuit, whatever is underlying that, is still preserved in the slice. it was sort of an interesting outcome of this, having the connectivity, is we could look at the probability of these different kinds of connections between interneurons and excitatory cells, the MOSI cells and the hilar interneurons. And one thing that came out was there was a overabundance of reciprocal connections between these cells. So there's the MOSI cells like to talk to the interneurons like to talk to MOSI cells. You can estimate the frequency you ought to see a reciprocal connection. And what we found was many more reciprocal connections than expected. Right? And this is a quadruple recording showing two interneurons and two excitatory MOSI cells. And there are five monosynaptic connections in this quadruple recording. This interneuron forms two reciprocal excitatory inhibitory paired reciprocal connections. And there's a divergent inhibitory connection on this other interneuron. So there is an abundance of these iterated motifs, but that still doesn't get us to explain where this persistent activity comes from. So the graduate student was sort of lost in the wilderness and very depressed after doing 500 some odd paired recordings, mostly in triples and quads, and no evidence for reverberation. So out of desperation, you start looking in the places where you don't, there should be no answer, and one place that he looked was in the molecular layer. So the granule cell layer here, we've been talking about cells in the hyalus, we're stimulating out here in the middle or outer molecular layer. And the answer turned out to be cells in the inner molecular layer, these blue cells. And the blue cells, when recorded with a multi-unit electrode, we saw persistent spiking after the stimulus, about the same time we saw persistent activity in the hyalus. And we recorded cell attached from the blue cells. We saw persistent spiking at the individual cell level, where the granule cells never showed this. So the blue cells seem like they were the candidate for this. When recorded intracellularly, we see beautiful, at least to us, beautiful plateau potentials in the blue cells that are graded with the intensity of the stimulus, where the granule cells show either nothing or inhibition. This is 58 of the blue cells looking at the integral here. And that integral, some of these cells don't respond, but the ones that do show a positive integral, where the granule cells under the same condition show usually nothing, or a negative integral, which means inhibition. So the blue cells turn out to be semilunar granule cells that Cajal described 100 years ago. So there he called the medialunar or half moon cells based on the shape of the soma, which is a little bit of an sort of here nor there description, but everything he had about their structure was right on. So the shape of the cell, the granule cell body is more egg-shaped, this is more half-moon shape. But the real meat of this is that the semilunar granule cells have their cell body out in the molecular layer and a much wider dendritic arborization than granule cells. So this is a granule cell near the top of the granule cell layer. Both these cells are polarized, so the dendrites go up, where they receive the input from the perforant path. The axon goes down into the hyalus. This is a fill, again, two-photon reconstruction from Alexa fill. The axon collaterals in the hyalus, and then the axon reaching CA3. The other thing that was unusual is these semilunar granule cells have collaterals in the intermolecular layer. And the granule cells never have that because they're polarized. Their axon stays down here. So they could never have an axon up here. So it's exactly how Cajal described it. This is a blow-up of another one of these semilunar granule cells with an axon collateral hugging the border between the intermolecular layer and the granule cell. So here's Cajal, here's our cell, and here's the cell C that has these much broader dendritic arborizations. So this has been in the literature for over 100 years, and no one has cared at all about these odd cells that are in Cajal's drawings in this picture of the dentate. But when you go and look, you find cells exactly like that. So this work, we published this in the end of 2007. It's been replicated. And these semilunar granule cells appear to play an important role in temporal lobe, in a model of temporal lobe epilepsy. So not only are they important for these discharges, but they might have a clinical importance. We did the paired recordings to prove that these are excitatory. So this is a semilunar granule cell. We filled the cell with Alexa under a two-photon microscope so we could see where the axon went. And then when we found that, we patched cells in the hilus, and this is a mossy cell, and you can actually see the contact between the axon and a tertiary dendrite of the mossy cell, and you can see the EPSP, which is facilitating, which is again part of this class of granule cells that tend to make excitatory facilitating synapses. So we know this cell, the semilunar granule cell, makes a monosynaptic input onto the hilus. When we do our trick of stimulating a couple of times in the perforant path, when we see the synaptic barrages in the hilus, we see the plateaus in the semilunar granule cell. So this is two different intensities, a lower intensity that doesn't produce the barrage, and almost no plateau here, a higher intensity with a plateau in this cell and a barrage in this cell. When you look in, blow this up, you can see the plateau develop over the different stimuli, and you can see a correspondence and increase in the frequency of synaptic input. Sure.
So a few clarifying questions. In these slices, is it blocked inhibition?
No, this is absolutely normal conditions.
Normal conditions.
No drugs.
And then what exactly is the stimulus parameter? Is perforant path strong stimulation, so you don't specify that?
Yes, so this is, usually we specify in terms of the minimal. This is actually the raw intensity. This is a monopolar tungsten electrode in the middle molecular layer. So this is maybe four to six times minimal, a little bit higher, and 10 times minimal here.
Minimal is defined as the stimulus that gives a postsynaptic EPSP half the time.
Yes, but it's a disynaptic. So we're not looking at the intermediate granule cell. We're seeing, you know, what's, we usually do this in separate experiments, but the minimal typically is in the range of maybe 40 to 50 microamps to get a disynaptic EPSP that has failures and successes. All right, so there's...
Is there any spontaneous activity in slice at the concentrations of ions you're using?
There is in the hilar cells. That's
Not in these cells.
Not in these cells, we're not seeing a lot of spontaneous EPSPs.
And you saw this in normal rats or mice in vivo?
We have seen in the hilus, we can stimulate the angular bundle, the perforant path, and we can produce this sort of synaptic barrage in an anesthetized mouse. Right. We haven't done the semilunar granule cells in vivo, and we haven't done the information coding part that I'll get to in vivo. But the phenomenon's there. And other people have recorded from mossy cells in monkey and shown they also have this unusual steady state synaptic tone, spontaneous inputs coming through.
And the kind of inputs that you need to generate this kind of persistent activity, you think such inputs can arise naturally? That amount, whatever, 200 microamps?
Well, so this, we'll get to this in a second. So this is the good and the bad of the slice, right? So the good is that we have complete control. The mechanism is constrained because we only have the circuit that's there in the slice. The bad is that we can't really mimic the natural patterns. The natural patterns is probably many more EPSPs coming when anurinal is doing something, but we can't put in, you know, 1,000 different electrodes to create those stochastic patterns of EPSPs. So we have one electrode in this experiment, and we'll get to having four electrodes down the road in the talk. But what we're doing is artificial in the sense that we're turning up, we're stimulating many axons near that electrode instead of having it be a diffuse stimulation. So...
One more question. So A3 is a blow-up of the left side of A2.
Right.
So it's a blow-up on the left side.
Or yes.
Do you think that you're getting your build-up even kind of within the stimulation?
Right. It's a correlation just between these two cells that we randomly, we're not saying these are synaptically connected, and we're not saying these are the only cells involved, but these two show this correspondence. So
it's interesting to see in this blow-up how this plateau potential is kind of built up over several spiking episodes. So are you going to talk a little bit about what causes this plateau? Is it
yes.
A circuit effect? Is it biophysics of this particular type of cell?
I'll say a little bit about it. We published this a couple of years ago, and there's a lot of gory detail in terms of the pharmacology to get at this that doesn't come to a, you know, beautiful, clean answer, but I'll show you a little bit of that. So where we are now is that we have resurrected Cajal's cells from that he described 100 years ago, and that these are a variant of the granule cell, but they presumably function differently because they listen to a broader swath of entorhinal cortex input than granule cells do. They're excitatory, they project onto granule cell, onto Hilar cells, and then onto CA3. They have these unusual axon collaterals. We don't know where those collaterals and molecular layer contact yet. And we know that the same stimulation protocol that makes persistent synaptic discharges in Hilar cells also creates these plateau potentials. So how do you go beyond just the correlation? We found three different treatments that can block the plateau in the blue cells and semilunar granule cells without blocking normal excitatory synaptic transmission. So we could certainly put on NBQX or another antagonist of AMPA receptors and everything stops, right? The input to this blue cell stops, but everything stops down here, so that's sort of a trivial answer. So the more interesting aspect is looking at agents that might leave normal synaptic transmission intact, but do something to disrupt the intrinsic properties that support the plateau. So these are not like the entorhinal cortical cells. We cannot stimulate or give a depolarizing step to the soma and trigger a plateau. But we think it is intrinsic and is triggered by NMDA receptors on the dendrites of these semilunar granule cells because the non-competitive antagonist MK801 blocks the plateau. And it leaves the fast EPSP but blocks this plateau. And we apply MK801. Looking at the Hilas, we see the fast synaptic response, but then no more synaptic barrage. And the EPSP here is a blown up view here to show that the AMPA mediated transmission is intact. This is over several experiments showing the MK801 gets rid of most of this integral of the reflecting the plateau and gets rid of this the increase in synaptic tone without affecting the slope of this disynaptic EPSP. And when we add on NBQX to block the AMPA receptors, this all goes away.
So do you increase, after you put on the MK2-1, do you increase the stimulus more and more to compensate?
We haven't done that, but we did get this to wash out after a couple of hours to show that at the same intensity, it will come back. But we haven't gone to see what's there in MK2-1. Yep.
Did you apply MK801 intracellular or extracellular?
This is extracellular.
And if you apply it intracellular?
We haven't tried that. Oh. Yeah.
So how long are these persistent states? Have you looked at it? Is it?
I will show you that, I think, in a little bit.
And then you call these up states here. Are these up states? Because is that the same as up states?
Well, so we are calling this synaptic discharge in upstate, but it's not, we're not getting to the circuit component of the upstate. We're just sampling this Hilar cell. And I'll show you in a minute when we do the multiple recordings at the same time, sort of what's happening in the network. So this is blocking blocking MDA receptors with MK201. We can do the same trick with blocking L-type calcium channels with nimodipine, and that also gets rid of most of the plateau and without blocking the fast synaptic transmission. And then we get rid of the plateau, we get rid of most of the synaptic discharge downstream. And then what's left in nimodipine is a very brief 50 or 100 millisecond period of the plateau, and that is sensitive to nickel, just a non-selective calcium channel antagonist, but also hits the low threshold calcium channels. And we can image, we have a supplemental figure in here imaging the calcium in these dendrites of the semilunar granule cells and show that there is a low threshold calcium current. So our guess is that there's an NMDA receptor dependent input in the distal dendrites or middle dendrites of these semilunar granule cells that recruits these intrinsic calcium channels that supports the plateau. And that's not a sort of very novel mechanism. There are many examples in different brain regions of intrinsic plateaus that are mediated by voltage-gated calcium channels. The problem here is that we don't know exactly how that works because we can't directly turn on the plateau with somatic current injection. Okay, so we have to do this with synaptic input, so it's a little bit messier than the case when this is really like in our entorhinal cortical cell where you can do this all cell autonomously. So the other thing that's weird about these cells is that they receive a different kind of excitatory input. These are a variant of granule cells. If we activate the NRIL input, we see at very weak intensities, we're recording actually monosynaptically, we're activating a perforant path, record monosynaptically, we can define minimal intensity for seeing failures and successes of this monosynaptic EPSP, and there is no difference in the amplitude of the unitary input to the two classes of cells. Right? And so this is measuring this in two different ways. On when the cell's held at minus 80 as an inward current, there's no difference across the granule cells and semilunar granule cells, and as an outward current at plus 55, no difference. But if we double the intensity, we see the granule cell response increases. These are different scales, so it's going from 20 to 200. But the semilunar granule cells, when you double the intensity, it becomes enormous. And it's not the case that we've triggered an unclamped spike. It's become because we see the same increase in intent in the recruitment of EPSPs when we have this as an outward current, right, going from this intensity of this, or this amplitude to this amplitude. So it's possible there could be some other kind of input that goes selectively to the semilunar granule cells. It's also possible that they have a denser pattern of NRIL inputs than the granule cells. Right? But whatever it is, they are primed to receive very strong excitatory input, especially as we increase the intensity of the stimulus. So we've got sort of the cellular part. We can see these plateaus. The plateaus can trigger spiking in the semilunar granule cells. We see downstream the synaptic discharge that also can trigger spiking in the hilar cells, and we think there are hilar interneurons that probably mediate this inhibition we see on the granule cells. So that's the circuit, and that's what happens when we stimulate at least part of that. And then the big question we had is, well, how global is this? If we stimulate one spot, do all the hilar cells respond the same way? And so the very simplest approach for this is simply having two different electrodes, presumably near different clusters of semilunar granule cells, and ask what happens in the hilars. So this is that experiment, and what we've done is sampled three different cells downstream. So it's a triple recording, triple intracellular recording from three hilar mossy cells, and those are the three cells here, and we stimulate in the two different locations in the molecular layer. And in this location, when we turn on the stimulus, we see a delay and then this synaptic barrage with spiking. We've cut off the spikes here. And it's only on this, only prominent on this third cell. So this tells you right away that this isn't something like an epileptic discharge that might go everywhere. And it's not probably like a wave of potassium or glutamate that might go throughout the hilus and excite everyone. It's really specific. And the other thing we can show you that how this is specific is we stimulate over in this site and we see synaptic barrages now in all three cells. So the same three cells respond differently depending on which set of NRIL input is activated. And it's not just those two episodes, so this is now four episodes. We go back and stimulate over here at site A and we see roughly the same kind of barrage that we saw before. We stimulate B and we see the same pattern roughly that we saw here. And this was actually 10 repetitions. So we can show you this in a couple of different ways. This is a vector representing all the trials where we stimulated here. And this was really done in three space, but we're showing you the two different, most different hilar cells. And we can look at the individual trials and we can look at the average response of those trials to the site A and site B, and these are really different. I'll show you the statistics on that in a minute. You can also look at this, since half the lab does olfaction, we can look at this as a trajectory plot, the way you would imagine sort of classic work on insect olfaction. You can see the response before the stimulus down here. These are individual points from 1 second windows here. And as we stimulate, the responses to B move up in this space here, formed by the frequency of EPSPs on this one cell and on another cell. And it moves out in this direction because all these cells are responding. the spike response to A moves in this direction because mostly it's this cell that's responding. Right? So Sarah helped us a lot when we were thinking about sort of ways to do the analysis on this. This became a supplemental figure, so thank you. And we can look at the overlap, so we can calculate all the responses. So if we know for three trials of A, so A and B, and we have a centroid, and we can calculate what we call the cis distances here from the median, from the centroid of A to the individual responses, and the same thing for B. And then we can calculate the trans distances, which are the wrong ones, say the individual response to B to the centroid of A. And we can look at the overlap between those. We can get an estimate of this from the fits. We can get an estimate of this area. And then we can shuffle the labels and get a probability of how likely it is that these two planetary systems really reflect two different kinds of responses. And in 12 experiments, all these were statistically significant. We did this also with linear discriminant analysis, and this is now into the second paper we did on this, where instead of just having two locations, we have a fixed array, a matrix electrode that has fixed four electrodes that are about 100 microns apart, and we stimulate each one of these individually, and then we're looking in the three space formed by the triple recording. So there are three EPSP, three MOSI cells, and we're plotting the frequency of EPSPs over the 4 seconds after the stimulus on each of those cells, right? And these dots are individual trials, and the pluses are the centroids of the response. And so in this experiment, with 12 or 13 trials, we can completely separate the responses to each of these stimuli and present it in random order. So for linear discriminant analysis, we need 6 planes to separate all 4 of these eggs. And we can say how many of those 6 planes did this work in. And in the 9 triple recordings, our average was 5.5 planes. So we're doing very well in terms of being able to use just a simple linear discriminant to say we can separate the cluster from B and A and C and so on. But this is dependent on having a lot of cells, for us having a lot of cells recorded. So this is what we get if we shuffle the labels. We get about 1.5 planes. We're up to 6.5 planes, 5.5 planes out of 6 possible with a triple recording. But if we throw away one of the cells that we're recording, we go down to 4 planes. And if we throw away 2 out of the 3 cells, we're just looking at single recordings, we can only do A versus B or C versus A. We've lost the ability to discriminate these 4 different eggs.
So these responses, which seem to depend on which electrode is stimulated, can they be predicted based on the pattern of innervation, because there's a bundle of axons coming in from perfon path? So if the neuron is just not receiving input, and if it's located here, it's just not going to respond to this electrode.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to just look at it from the point of view of whether these neurons are likely to receive input or not from the axon which is getting stimulated, or is there more than
that? So we're not probably stimulating a single axon.
No, bundle of axons.
Yeah, so it's a bundle.
Like this bundle versus this bundle, like at the top versus bottom, those guys may not just be getting input.
Let me come back to this. So I'm going to show you this in a little bit more detail. I'm going to show you the contextual information, and then I'm going to come back at the end to the semilunar granule cells and try and get to that point. And then if I don't get to it, ask me again. Yep.
You probably get to this, but what it has to be doing, needs to be doing something, right? If it's reflecting the input, you haven't gained anything. It has to be processing the input in some way that can read out easier. It doesn't seem to have any attractive to that input, so it can't be doing that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what it's actually doing? I mean, you could read out, which electrodes are being activated from the electrodes themselves much more easily than presumably from the higher cells, right?
I'm going to come to that in a second. I'm going to come to how well you can read this out at the first layer. And we do better by sampling broader down in here. So these cells, I'm going to get to this, the semilunar granule cells are really much more specialized to respond more narrowly to this.
So you can't do better with an optimal decoder. You must do better with a linear decoder. Because, I mean, EPI, right? You can't do
better. Yeah.
So you say you do better with a linear decoder?
Yeah. Yeah, but let me show you that and then we can come back to this. So the point I'm trying to make here, and then maybe there'll be more questions that I can get to after I show you the responses up here of the first layer. But right now I'm just trying to make the point that having three cells gives you a lot more information than having one cell. And in each of these stages of looking at single recordings, paired recordings, triple recordings, we're doing much better with the actual data than if we shuffled the identity. So we'd expect by chance. So there is information that we can see by recording in these Hiler cells, and it looks like a population code. This is another way, so our department I'm in is mostly molecular biology, developmental biology, and they're happier when we can show them graphical representations. So we made this glyph plot where we have four different centroids, and each trial, as close as it gets to a centroid, we have a function that grades the intensity of the four letters. And so before the stimulus, all the letters are about equal, so you can't see anything. And this is one experiment with 13 trials, and we stimulate here. We move the individual trial, moves very close, in this case, to the centroid of D, so that letter becomes much darker. This isn't a mistake. So this is one trial where we stimulated in a C, and it moved somewhere in between. And this is with all the data. We can do this where we just use half the data, produce the map of the centroids, and then run the other half through. So it works with cross-validated data. The mistakes, when there are mistakes, it's informative. If we look at just how close individual pairs of these centroids are, the ones that are always classified correctly over 12 experiments have an average distance of about 20 or 25 hertz. So this is still in this weird EPSP space formed by the three cells. And the pairs of responses that are incorrectly classified some of the time tend to have smaller spacing. So the ones that were, there are one error, two errors, three errors, and repetitions of these are smaller and smaller spacing. So the idea is you've got a cloud of these points, and the closer the two clouds are, the harder it is to tell them apart. So there are a couple ways to improve on that. We can only guess. We can make a system that only guesses when their clouds are a certain distance apart. Overall, when we take all our data, we're about 76% correct classifying which one of the four responses, which one of the four electrons was turned on. We can bring that all the way up to almost 100% by only guessing on the clouds that are far apart. And we can also predict what the perfect classification would be. So this is a regression from the incorrect cases, and this is the distance of the correctly classified pairs. And that doesn't really match, but if we just do a manipulation where we scale the distance by the variance in the cloud, then we have a pretty close prediction of the scaled distance you need to get to perfectly classify the responses.
The variance is depending, it changes from cloud to cloud?
This is, I think, based on the average variance between the two pairs that were, the two clouds. Okay. All right, so that's locations. The other cool part of this, at least to us, so the locations, I'll just back up and say, this is all done in the Hilers. We're now repeating a lot of this in the neocortex. And we can show, I don't have the data here, but we can show that we can separate these location stimuli using the same kind of electrode recording in neocortical slices that are where we've increased the excitability with a muscarinic receptor agonist. So we can produce a persistent firing in neocortex. We don't know which cells play the role of the semilunar granule cells yet, but the same kind of scheme seems to work where we can record triples in neocortex and we can tell them apart, tell which stimulus was turned on.
In any neocortex or trunk?
This is now, the only thing we've done right now is temporal neocortex, so we haven't done...
So it's a general cortical phenomenon.
We think it's general. We haven't gone to test different areas, but we've done 10 micromolar carbachol, the same kind of electrode placed in a deep layer and stimulating and recording three cells in layer 5-6. And we can do the same trick of having information about which electrode was turned on. So we're looking now to see how generalizable the mechanism is. In the Hilers, we've gone on to show we can not only record generate information about the cell, the locations that are turned on, but also contextual information. So now we have the same electrode, matrix electrode, and we just turn on contact A, and then 5 seconds later, contact B, contact C, contact D. And we can do that in this order, or we can do it in the reverse order. And just ask at the end of the sequence, can you tell them apart in the same weird EPSP space? And this is one experiment where the clouds of points and the centroids are different, and we can prove and show that they're different using linear discriminant analysis. This was 11 experiments, and the forward and reverse sequences were separable in 10 out of the 11 by linear discriminant.
And where are the muscarinic fibers that are causing that? You're using an agonist, right?
In neocortex.
In neocortex.
Yes.
An agonist. And where is the acetylcholine coming from?
Well, it could be coming from brainstem or basal forebrain.
Exactly. You don't know where it's coming from.
Right. So we don't know which cell types are essential to receive cholinergic input within all the different kinds of cells in the cortex. So what's happening to code the sequence is really interesting. We see evidence for contextual information here. So if we look within the stimuli that generate the sequence, we know at the end we can tell forward versus reverse sequence apart. We can also tell the difference between a reverse sequence and just presenting A by itself and a forward sequence just presenting D by itself. So this system knows information about the order of the sequence and that there was a sequence instead of just a single response. And when we look as the response builds up, this is now just the mean frequency across the three cells, you see the evidence of the context. So if we look at just the third stimuli C here in the forward sequence, the mean EPSP frequency doesn't really go up very much here. Where in the same stimulus in a different context, where it comes in the reverse sequence, C now produces a big change in the average EPSP frequency.
And then how long apart in time are these stimuli?
They are still pairs where they're half second apart, and then the different types of stimulus are 5 seconds apart.
And if you change that?
I'll get to that in 1 second. So this is showing the context of the C. This is another way to show context. So if we take the individual the responses as they build up, the individual ABCDs, and make a vector of those in this EPSB3 space and add them head to tail, if the order didn't matter, if the context didn't matter, you get to the same spot. But you don't get to the same spot here with this 5 seconds between the responses. You end up with a very different location. But if you broaden this out to 120 seconds, now the order doesn't matter, right? So there's something about with something faster than 120, right around 5 seconds, and this works, where you get context out of this. You get a sequence order dependence.
And you're recording in layer 5.
This is back to Hylas.
In cortex. Would you say again?
It's layer 5-6.
Layer 5-6, and where are the stimulating electrodes?
They are also in the deeper layers.
Okay.
But we haven't exhaustively...
You don't know where the fibers are.
Yeah, we haven't exhaustively shown where we'd have to go to not see this yet. This is getting at, is this now really temporal order, or is this something about encoding the 5 seconds between the responses? And so in this experiment, we did a forward sequence, A, B, C, D, at 5 seconds, a reverse sequence, DCBA, at 5 seconds, and then a reverse sequence a little bit shorter. So this is every 4 seconds. And you can see that visually that the coding of this, where it comes out in this EPSB space, is not very much dependent on the actual interval, but depends on the sequence order. And so there are a couple of ways we analyze this. We could draw a line between the centroids of the two 5-second sequences and do a projection pursuit where we map on this short response. And we do that, these trials with the short reverse map at the same point roughly as the trials with the 5 second reverse sequence. And this is where the forward 5 seconds is. So it doesn't look like it's encoding the actual interval, it's encoding the identity, the sequence identity, and it's robust to at least this perturbation of going from 5 to 4 seconds. We can also look at this in accuracy, and we lose very little accuracy going down to the short sequence, classifying in a world that is based on the 5 second forward and reverse sequence. Yep.
So there are two questions. One is it possible to go even lower? Instead of 20% reduction, like, I don't know, 2 seconds?
We haven't done that. I'll show you in a second what the timing requirement is for this.
Okay.
Let me just show you that now. That's right. This is another supplement. So this is not permuting, not altering the interval. It's separate experiments with different intervals. And this is the data I've been showing you, 5 second intervals. And this is, to encode a sequence, you have to do two things. You have to encode whether it's a forward and reverse, forward or reverse sequence, and this is a Euclidean distance between these two centroids. And you have to tell that it's a sequence, not the individual response. So you have to tell the difference between ABCD versus D and DCBA versus A. And that Euclidean distance between those two centroids is on this axis. And so to tell a sequence, you have to be out in this world here. And so this works at 5 seconds. It works pretty well at 8 seconds. It doesn't work at 120 seconds. You can still say ABCD is different than DCBA, but that's trivial because you've lost the ability to tell that it's a sequence versus the last one. All you're doing is essentially living in a world with the last stimulus. And 2 seconds doesn't work for the other reason that this all gets meshed up here. It's going too fast to have this circuit develop whatever the contextual representation is. You end up just having the difference between a sequence and the last. So we don't know much more than this right now in terms of what are the temporal requirements, but it's somewhere in this range of 5 to 8 seconds is what we know works.
And how about the speed of going through the sequence?
That's what this is. This is the intervals between the
but doing the sequence. How long is it between stimuli and the sequence?
That's this. That's what these 2 seconds
mean. You can reverse the question.
Oh, between. Yes, between them.
So we always wait about 3 minutes. So we give a trial, and that's what limits all this and how many trials we can get. So we can maintain a triple intracellular recording maybe for an hour or 80 minutes in a slice. And that limits us because we have to wait for everything to subside after we give a trial.
Will it take 3 minutes? Is that the decay time for tens of seconds?
The tau for these responses are, in the 8 to 10 seconds. But there's a slow recovery down to completely diagonal baseline, and we want to make sure that there is no leftover influence. So we're waiting usually 2 to 3 minutes between every trial.
So here too, are you going to come to this later on, whether the cell is in the path of the axon bundle versus not?
I'm going to get to that a little bit. Maybe I won't get to enough, but right. I'll show you a little bit of this. So we think that we're robust to this sort of little bit of perturbation of the interval. And so this is arguing that we're encoding the identity of the sequence, not the 5 seconds as the interval. This works within a range that sort of fits with this working memory where you can show this delay cell activity for 5 or 10 seconds. So we don't want to make too much out of this because this is the hippocampus. Most of the world thinking about short-term memory thinks about neocortical systems, although there are some precedents for the delay cell activity in behaving animals in hippocampus. But we're interested in this as a mechanism that can encode different kinds of information that works in a conventional rodent brain slice. And so the last part I want to say is a little bit about how we think this might work, and this is this third out of the three papers, we hope, on this Hyler system. And there are a couple of different ways you can imagine this happening, right? So we can imagine that we stimulate two different locations. We have semilunar granule cells that belong to this electrode and other ones that belong to this electrode, which is sort of what you're getting to. You can imagine that all the semilunar granule cells are driven to some degree by any of these different stimulating electrodes, right? And so it's just a variation in the magnitude of the response or the plateau state. And you can imagine that maybe what happens is more complex, that the cells, the semilunar granule cells, all respond to the stimulus, but then how they respond is different depending on some aspect of the circuit. And so we're beginning to try and dissociate that. And so this is responses of the semilunar granule cell to the four different locations. So this is not a sequence, this is going back to the locations, individual trials of A, B, C, D. And this semilunar granule cell made a plateau reproducibly just to D. So it was highly specific in this world where the only thing you can do is turn on one of these four electrodes. And so what we've plotted here is sort of an estimate of how fixated this particular cell is on one of the electrodes. And so we say, what's its favorite response? What's its biggest average response? We call that a preferred response. And this is just a quantification over 7 experiments of the fraction of the trials where the integral matched what the preferred response for that cell was. And so these cells are really specific. About 90% of their responses are in what is the average response, whereas we shuffle, we're down to 25. We can do the same thing to ask how restricted are the Hilar cells downstream. And they also have a favorite electrode, but it's not as strong a preferred response. So the Hilar cells are down to about 75% of the responses are in the largest average response versus 90%. So then this is another way of looking at that now. So this is their preferred response, the one that has the largest average integral. So we just rank that. We make that 1 for semilunar granule cells and then for Hilar cells. And when we ask, how selective are they? So if we go to their second most preferred response, what happens? And the semilunar granule cells now are dropped to about 1/3 of the response to their preferred. And then by the third, the third most favored electrode, they're down to nothing. Right? Whereas the Hilar cells have a much more gradual response. They have their favorite electrode, but then the second most favored is only 80% different. Or it's only 20% loss from that, and so down to the third, and their least preferred is about half the response of the B.
And wouldn't this depend a lot on how many cells you stimulate when you stimulate electrodes and how far apart they are?
Right, so we haven't done sort of this experiment where we grade the intensity to ask. In this experiment, we haven't done that. We've done a little bit to say that this doesn't fall apart from this scheme if we go up, you know, maybe twofold in intensity. It's not the case that this selectivity is because we had a magic intensity. This is pretty robust over maybe a twofold change in intensity that you would see this degree of selectivity in the first order cells.
How far are the electrodes and what's the stimulating current in these cells you're thinking of?
We can't tell you though how many cells. So it's the electrode spacing is 115 microns. And these are typically maybe 100 to 200 microamps of the monopolar stimulation. So this is showing sort of an intuitive idea of how the location information probably is encoded. So individual semilunar granule cells are pretty well tuned to have their favorite electrode. Hilar cells are one synapse below. They have big dendrites. So it's a sort of intuitive story that the Hilar cells listen to a lot more semilunar granule cells so they can integrate across the different preferences of these first order cells. And so when you look at the accuracy of individual cells, both of these first order and second order, the semilunar and the Hilar cells, both can tell apart locations. They can tell A versus B, not as well as a triple, but the individual cells have that information. Right? And it's also at about the same accuracy. So you haven't really gained anything going from an individual semilunar granule cell to an individual Hilar cell.
So again, when you looked at it, you look at like the distance thing, when they can tell distance, like is it closer to the path or something?
Well, so the distance is not probably the most, it's not a parameter that's going to be the most informative, because what we're having in the Hilas are three cell bodies that are all very close. So to do, technically, to do the triple recordings, we're all, the three cell bodies are probably within 100 microns of each other, but they have dendrites that go throughout the hyalas. Yeah. So we have no idea, sort of, there's probably no spatial topography. And we looked at that to some degree in the first paper to say, you know, there's no, certainly you can't tell by the spatial location of A versus the two stimulating electrodes, A or B, which one's closest to the cells we're recording from wasn't necessarily the one that made the response.
Back one slide for a sec.
Sure.
Back one slide. Okay, so chances of 25%, right? On the right hand side?
Yeah, so it's not 25, so chance for telling one which of the four locations should be 25%, but because we have relatively small groups here, the linear discriminant will end up with one group a little bit bigger than the other group, and that's why these are never exactly at 25%. So these shuffled means we've just randomized the labels of whether we call A, B, C, D, which responds, and then we just rerun it, rerun the linear discriminant. So we'll still try and classify groups.
So you still try to classify based on random data.
Right, so it's not really, so chance should be 25%, but it's higher than that because it gets, it just gets whatever clumps of data that it has. So the cool part to us is that when you do the same trick looking at the contextual information, looking at coding the sequences, there appears to be almost no information at the single cell level in either the first order or these hyalur cells. Right? And these are the same cells, though, at an individual cell that can tell information about locations. So the same cells that can't tell you the sequence identity can tell you it was A versus D or it was a single response versus a sequence. Both of those are above chance. So these cells represent sort of this primitive kind of information about locations, but don't represent the contextual information about the sequences. But they actually are part of a population that does. So these are individual cells, but they're taken from triple recordings, just analyzed individually. And so when you give back the population representation, now you can tell the sequence identity. Right? So there's something going on with this encoding the sequence that requires the population. Right?
Linear decoders?
Yeah. Well, so there's probably some small difference here that's amplified. So, I mean, you can imagine a set of these points where they can be unable to, they can do the A versus D, but they're interspersed in a way that can't be decoded linearly to get the context, right? And we're working on this now. The other thing that's interesting about this is there looks to be an effect of temporal correlations where we can, if we make, instead of getting rid of the individual cells, we can get rid of the simultaneity. So we have a triple recording, but we swap around the different episodes. And so we have A, cell A and cell B and cell C from different episodes, but still tied to the correct stimulus. That kind of shuffling, the trial shuffling, doesn't affect the accuracy of this kind of information, but does impair the accuracy of this. So we think there's another aspect to this contextual representation that involves something that happens in each trial separately, or it happens in a different way in each trial. We think that probably is development of inhibition that modulates this response, right? And so that interplay between excitation and inhibition is what converts these very simple first-order cells that can do location information into a population of cells downstream that can do the context information. But we don't know exactly how that works yet. So here's where we are. So that's the summary of this. The locations work at the single-cell level. The sequences don't work very well, or in this case, the means aren't even any different at the single-cell level, but do work at the triple recording state. And so I'll just end at that point over. So we have in the hippocampus, so a very evolutionarily old part of the brain, we think we've stumbled into something that's perhaps generalizable, where there's a class of cells that Cajal described are called semilunar granule cells that receive excitatory input just like granule cells do, but listen more broadly to entorhinal cortex and have this ability to generate plateaus, probably as a consequence of NMDA receptors turning on voltage-gated calcium channels. When those plateaus happen, that triggers these higher up states, these synaptic barrages. Lots of glutamate input. We can show that those higher barrages are not global, but they're highly synaptic, highly synapse-specific. So different semilunar granule cells project differently to higher cells. And when we turn on different clusters of semilunar granule cells, we can encode both location and the identity of sequences. And we think that probably this contextual information about the sequences, and we also can do this with logical and bring the slides on that. We think that this contextual information probably comes from interaction between an excitatory signal and an inhibitory signal. And so I'll just end with that. So this original work finding the semilunar granule cells was Phil Larimer, who's an MD PhD student, and Phil Williams, who's a postdoc. And then the work on the sequences in that whole paper was Robert Hyde, who's also another MD PhD student. So, thank you.
So you said that you couldn't generate it, the plateaus in the SGCs with somatic
right.
pulses. Is it with under carbachol also?
No, we've not tried that under carbachol. But this, the whole Hyler story is without carbachol.
I see. They look a lot like the Fraser and McVicker plateaus with carbachol.
Right.
C1.
So there is a world of these voltage-gated calcium channel plateaus. There's spinal cells in the spinal cord that do this. And they all are a little bit different. And so Michael's work on entorhinal has shown sort of variations in the firing state, right, that probably track something to do with internal calcium and ICANN current. In the olfactory bulb, we see this persistent firing in this Blanus cell, this weird interneuron, and there it's very, very precise firing. Very little difference in the interval. Here we see sort of these sloppy plateaus that are a little bit higher, a little bit lower. The firing out of it doesn't look as regular. So it probably is a clue, but until we're able to get much more of spatial localization on triggering these plateaus and looking up in the dendrites of these cells, we're probably not going to get the real mechanism yet.
Ben, the brain has to be able to get sequence information on lots of time scales, and this is on the time scale of working memory. But do you have any ideas about what the real short time scales would be, like the auditory cortex would have to be used?
Right. So what we have done is sort of manipulate the system in the simplest possible way for us to interpret it, where we get these long-lasting plateaus for seconds. And I think probably that's not physiological. I don't think we get this enormous synchronous bolus of EPSPs that knocks in the semilunar granule cell to be up for seconds, right? So I think what happens physiologically maybe is this mechanism scaled down to be working in the 50 or hundreds of milliseconds period. And so we haven't looked at that time scale where if we go to a condition, say, where we put on blockers of L-type calcium channels and just leave the T current, right, would we be able to do this sort of trick of encoding information, 10 times faster? We know the currents are there to support these little plateaus from low threshold calcium channels.
I see. So you would say that this may be, you're not saying it is, but it could conceivably be a general sequence detection mechanism that would work on many time scales depending on exactly what the input was going to be that caused them.
Right. I mean, we can tell these semilunar granule cells have the currents to support multiple time scales that we can reveal pharmacologically. We haven't gone the next step to say, can we create an experimental regime either with weak stimuli or by blocking the long duration? The currents that probably support the long duration. Right? But I think the general mechanism, if there is one, is the is a combination. I mean, certainly know in neocortex there are recurrent excitatory connections. There's probably a way to show what's happening in neocortex, whether you get persistent spiking in a behavioral task that's mediated by this recurrent network versus an intrinsically amplified time scale. I think that's sort of the key experiment. But it's probably going to be a combination. It's probably going to be not just a recurrent synaptic network that creates the persistent firing, but a combination of having recurrent connections with cells that have some ability to lengthen the response.
And if you change muscarin concentration, can you change time scales?
We haven't done that in neocortex yet, and the hippocampus work is all without any.
Yeah, I know, but in neocortex.
Well, we haven't looked at that. We have just, we are using a moderate concentration, so 10 micromolar of carbachol. I should have brought some of the slides. We're just making that paper up now, but it's, I think the problem in neocortex is that it's probably, we need to turn on the M1 receptors on a specific set of cells in neocortex, and the rest don't matter, or maybe it makes them bigger, but the key cells that play the role of some of the granule cells are the sort of, that's what we're trying to get to in neocortex to understand sort of what if there is a commonality between these brain areas. There ought to be cells that are just listening, like to play the role of the higher cells, and cells that are creating the intrinsic time delay.
Do there seem to be cholinergic inputs for these semilunar granule cells?
We don't know that. So there's certainly cholinergic input to the Hyler cells that has a big effect on changing their intrinsic time scale. So if you give a depolarizing step to a Hyler Mossi cell, there is no persistence. How big the step is, there's no after depolarization. There's a after hyperpolarization. That is very different, though. If you turn on cholinergic inputs to the Hylas, there's a cell type selective modulation in the after potential. So if you turn on M1 receptors in the Hylas, now the Mossi cells can do an anorinal-like intrinsic persistence, but the Hyler interneurons right next to them can't. So it's very selective modulation there. But this is all without turning. We've also done the control where we stimulate and we block muscarinic receptors to prove that this effect that we're seeing in the slice really isn't because we've turned on endogenous acetylcholine.
Yeah. Could I ask you to go back to, there was a plot when you showed us the sequences at 5 seconds and a longer time and the close that you hit. So, if you look at the 5 seconds interval, the A arrow is not very different, the B arrow is not very different, the C is a little bit different, but the main difference is in the D. So maybe all that matters is that D came after C in one case and D not came after C in the other one. So although you're doing the recognition of the whole sequence, I wonder whether you're remembering the whole sequence or whether you're just remembering the context of the last two steps.
So that, yes.
Yeah. So would you be able to distinguish A, B, C, D from G, F, C, D?
Yes. So I didn't put the figures in because we're just making this third paper now. The IPSP signal that we think interacts with this EPS. So the EPSP signal is more or less coming from the locations. It doesn't have the context information in it very much. The IPSP signal looks like the integration of all the activity over the past 5 or 10 seconds. So we think that sort of recency signal interacts probably through a presynaptic inhibition to control the contextual representation, and that's why you get this recency effect you're talking about.
Okay.
But we haven't done, so we also haven't done sort of permutations of the sequence at that level of sort of changing whether we can do, you know, let's move one around in there to see if there's a pivotal one. But we think there is something about recent activity that ends up being somehow subtracted or interfering with the EPSP signal. Right, and we have a little bit of data with blocking GABA-B receptors to sort of suggest of how this might work.
Yeah, The other thing is how long the sequence do you think the system can remember?
Yeah, we haven't done that yet either. So,
But now I'm a little confused. I would have thought with the 120 second sequence, that's A is on for 120 seconds, B is on for 120
seconds. No, these are just the intervals. It's still a transient stimulus, and then it's the interval between the next one.
A comes on, and then you wait 120 seconds.
Yes.
And you get persistent activity for a whole 120
seconds? No. We're just we are waiting 2 to 3 minutes to say that we have flushed out everything from the last one.
So this is a mislabeling. So these are milliseconds, aren't they? 5 milliseconds, 120 milliseconds?
No. These are the intervals between the trials.
Oh, okay.
Right, so we stimulate. So
different stimuli, not trial. Trial is a whole sequence.
Right. Different stimuli. Sorry.
Within the sequence.
Yeah, yes.
So A comes on for a few milliseconds, mm-hmm. and you wait 5 milliseconds.
A comes on for 100 microseconds.
Okay.
Right? It actually means 2 pulses of A, but they're transient stimuli. And then we wait 5 seconds, or we wait 120 seconds, and then give the beat.
So does I thought an EPSP stays constant the whole time? So in the plot where the mean EPSP frequency hertz.
This is, in here, these are 1 second averages, right? So we give A, and then we're looking across the 3 cells, and these plots here are each second of that 5 second gap between A and B.
So a very long time comes, so the firing rate hardly drops at all.
Yeah.
But if you wait 120 seconds, wouldn't the firing rate just go down to 0?
Yeah, so this is just for 5 seconds.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, if we had done 120 seconds, these things, you would be weighed, these dots would come down.
What are you applying in the lower right? Is that just the 1 second after the...
This is taking the response to the 4 seconds after each of these stimuli.
Oh, you wait 120 seconds between stimuli.
Right, so this is the 4 seconds right after that stimuli, what's that vector in the 3 space? And then we do the same thing and just add it head to tail, right? But there is another almost 2 minutes between this that's not included in that vector. So maybe it's cheating because
plot is a bit misleading then.
Yeah, well, it's the same analysis here where each of these arrows is based on 4 second averages, right? But there is a gap here of 116 seconds that's not included in the arrow.
During which you have lost persistent activity, that's the point.
So the plot above that, though, that you can actually, if you look at the final activity, you can tell between the...
Right.
If you look at activity, you would know which one it was between those two.
Yes.
Whereas 120 seconds, you look at the final activity, you would have no idea. Well,
yeah,
final activity would be zero.
Yeah. But this is not always the case that you can tell the sequence is based on population of the magnitude of the response. Right. If it were that way, then the single cell would work reliably over chance.
Right.
So is this what you're referring to as multistable states? Because you said that was one of your alternative hypotheses. And when I thought multistable states, I thought you were referring to the work that I did with Angel Alonso.
Yeah, no, I'm not calling this multistable states. This is just a plot of the magnitudes, right?
So when you listed that as a separate hypothesis of multistable states,
we don't have any evidence yet on this. What we have seen in the locations where we have the 4 different electrodes, we turn them on individually, is this sort of mechanism where individual semilunar granule cells make a plateau that's sort of consistent from trial to trial, but just to one, usually just to one contact. And so it's not the case that, this mechanism, we don't think this is the case where, the B response drives the plateau to a lower level.
Right. And yet you do see graded differences in, the background firing rate there. Do you think that's coming from different sources, maybe?
Graded.
We'll go to the next slide again. Or just, yeah.
This?
No, the one that we were just talking about with that one. If you look at the right-hand side with B, C, B, they're going to different mean EPSP frequencies.
Right.
Do you think that's coming from different cells, possibly?
Yes. Yeah. We think it's, This is a context experiment. So this is creating a sequence. And there are a couple of things that could be going on. One is that we're recruiting different senolytic granule cells. The other thing is that these are the individual responses, right? So B in isolation, A in isolation, D in isolation. In some of these cases, we see iPSPs. You can see a hyperpolarization on a semilunar granule cell to its non-preferred electrode. When we turn on B, C, sometimes we see what looks like an iPSP. Right? And so as a context, to show context, it's possible that the response to D, its favored electrode, is influenced if there was an iPSP just before. Right? So if we went CD, this iPSP might influence this response to D. Right? So that is, in a way, sort of getting at this idea that the semilunar first stage response could be plastic based on the context, or context could come on downstream, one synapse below, where the semilunar granule cells really like C turn on integrons that influence the EPSPs that we see in the hylas. Yeah.
Have you tried the sequence analysis in the semilunar cells? There may be some temporal interaction.
So that is this. We haven't done it, so it's in single cells. And this is the answer that we can't detect anything above the shuffle.
But how about in triples? You can't.
We haven't done triples with a semilunar. Yeah.
I wonder what's the effect of the plateau potential on the downstream neurons. Is once these cells are only synaptic pockets of the semilunar?
No. It is certainly MOSI cells and hyalur interneurons and CA3 cells. We don't have a pair, right? But we assume, because the axon makes it, at least the CA3C, that they are going to be like regular granule cells. They go to stratum lucidum and probably synapse on the proximal dendrite. But we have done the controls where we cut off CA3, and we can at least do this. We can generate these similar kinds of barrages. We haven't asked if cutting off CA3 or cutting off entorhinal cortex modulates our uridine code information, but it doesn't sort of change the type of synaptic barrages we see.
So is a granule cell in dendritic terms also receive influence from the semilunar cell?
So they have these weird axon collaterals that go in the molecular layer. They go sort of the intermolecular layer. And we don't know the targets yet. So it could be the case that they hit granule cell dendrites. It could be the case they also innervate interneurons in the dentate gyrus. Or maybe they go, we don't think it's that likely, but it's possible that they might hit the soma of other semilunar granule cells.
Ben, could you go back two slides? It looks to me like that feed-forward inhibition is about the same magnitude for all of the non-preferred. Is that normal?
We don't know yet. That's one of the analyses we're doing, is to what extent the IPSP codes anything, or whether it reflects the global. You know, we've looked at inhibition on the hylas, and that the IPSPs or IPSCs don't encode information about location or sequence identity nearly as well as EPSPs do. So we think it gets homogenized.
So this looks like the perforant pathway input has pretty spatially specific EPSPs and broad feed-forward IPSPs,
yes.
Which you might expect anyway.
Yes, yes. At least with this kind of analysis. So we are creating a sort of large input here that's certainly going to wake up all the interneurons along the way. Yeah?
Is there an existing propagator from the input output? Like, only give the pulse at A and then the position Y. Mm-hmm. And if you have a different waveform, like a continuous wave, at A, mm-hmm. is it going to still predict the waveform at
Yeah, so we can't, we haven't, what you're asking, I think, is sort of how this would work with physiological inputs that are not these synchronous activation of axons, right? And so we haven't done that yet of trying to create, you know, interesting temporal patterns of EPSPs to see how they get translated into persistent synaptic input downstream. But I think that we can't really do that as easily in the slice, but that's sort of the next step to try and do this within the campus is try and get the whole animal there and have the animal generate the neuronal activity patterns that drive the circuit. So I think that will come sort of with more, when we have more of a circuit there.
Would there be any additivity between, like if you give input from both A and B?
Yeah, we have that done. I mean, I just didn't bring the slides. That's in this third paper. So we can tell, we can do logical AMPs. So we can tell the difference between A, giving A alone, giving B alone, and giving A plus B.
And is the signal addictive?
It's, yeah, I can try.
What was the question?
Is it
additive?
Yeah, so there is a sort of diminishing response. In average, when you look during a sequence, you don't keep going up and up and up on average the same amount. So this is one experiment. So these particular changes are specific to that experiment. But on average, the boost you get from the last stimulus is not as big as the boost you got from the first. It goes down about 20%. There's probably some maximum number of stimuli you can encode this way before it saturates.
Let's thank Ben again. We'll see you again at 11.